I'd like to give some examples and some experiences this morning about using agronomic research to help to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. And particularly, one of the first issues is how we take the research we have and translate it into improved crop management practices. And that is enhancing the profitability and productivity for farmers, and also to ensure the sustainability in an acceptable environmental fashion. And you can see here that we're picking out those words of profitability, productivity, sustainability, and the environment, and those are very much along the lines of the ecological intensification concept that Akeem touched on, that Ken Kassman and others have been instrumental in developing. Now, a second issue here is that we also want to ensure that we're catalyzing a rapid, wide-scale uptake of these improved practices, that we're really using science-based guidelines to help us in going to local extension, and that we're ensuring that these guidelines can help enable farmers in the optimization of their decision-making, so that the technologies that arise from the research we do can really go out and reach millions of farmers. And I'm going to try and touch upon these four points as I go through this presentation. One is that we're setting science-based measures or indicators of success, that we're focusing on key opportunities and constraints, that we're using science-based principles when it comes to integrating several technologies or solutions, and that we're condensing research findings into simple guidelines for local implementation. Now here, this follows up nicely with what Akeem and Bruce have mentioned. If we look at a crop simulation model, for example, at the yield potential of a variety with a given climate, we get a particular yield, but what the farmers are actually achieving in terms of their yield under their conditions is often much less. Let's say 60% or 65%, as Akeem said. What we're really aiming for then, or when we're talking about setting a target or an indicator of success, is setting some target as a percentage of that yield potential. So with the ecological intensification concepts, that can be about 80% of the yield potential. So we're then closing that yield gap with improvements that are coming from the research we're doing. Now here I'll draw upon some of the experiences from the long-term experiment. This is the long-term continuous cropping experiment at Erie, the one with three crops per year. This is the dry season. The top line is the yield potential as indicated with the ARISA model, but it's been done also with other models that are quite consistent to this. And this is the measured yield that's been obtained with the highest yielding cultivar in the experiment. So when we look then at how well we're doing against our indicator of success, which would be 80% of the yield potential, we can see that with the management practices, it has been achievable at times. So this is the days of Ken Kassman. Ken, really well, this job well done. I've been trying hard to keep up with you. Now, when we look at the late wet season, same type of figure. Now, well, sorry, Ken, neither of us succeeded here. So we'll come back to this issue, but you can see sometimes we do it, sometimes we don't. Now, what are some of the key opportunities and constraints? This here is a study from focus group discussions with farmers, and these farmers are essentially non-adopters of some of our technologies. This is in southern India with transplanted rice. This is in the Mekong Delta of Vietnam with direct wet-seeded rice. So labor is particularly important. Something we need to remember is that with transplanted rice, which is common in Asia, two-thirds of the cost, the input cost, is labor. It dramatically reduces with direct wet-seeding, but still it's quite high. Fertilizer is often the second most important input cost, followed by pesticides and seeds. Irrigation water is very difficult to quantify, and we know, of course, it's a very important issue that goes beyond just the cost. Now, in terms of how we develop solutions and setting also targets of how we're going to focus on that profitability issue with high yield. When we look at a particular input, easy to think of this in terms of a fertilizer input, we're, if this is the current situation and we're going to some improvement, one strategy that's often mentioned in Asia, often mentioned among scientists, is to save that input, essentially shift that response curve to the left. Now, what we can do is we can save that input, but we don't change the yield. Now, the other strategy is really to increase that yield, increase that output, and not be so concerned about what that input does. The input actually may not change, but if we can increase that output, this gives us a considerable more profitability. And this is quite important because we'll see cases where strategies have been towards saving input versus increasing the output. And there are some ongoing impact assessments right now in Asia from the research, and they're really coming out and showing that the second strategy is one in which the impacts can be greater. Now, as we go to integration of technologies, we could say we may be even trying to raise that intercept and shift that response curve more as we select the best integrated combinations. Now I'm going to talk about nutrients, particularly nitrogen, residue, plant population, and integration. Get into some issues that have been mentioned and are quite important. Now, the steps here in terms of site-specific nitrogen management are the same as they would be in the United States or elsewhere. We're really looking, first of all, at the first step of making an estimate before the season of the total amount of fertilizer that's needed, and then also an estimate of how much to put on with that first application and when to time the first application. Now, in the Asian rice production situation, split applications are much more important. Here in the United States or Australia, much of the fertilizer goes on early. In the Asian rice context, perhaps because of the more importance of disease and other factors, split application, getting the optimal growth of the plant is incredibly important. Now, to set up, just show some of the approaches that and how the approach has evolved in terms of nitrogen management, building upon the site-specific nutrient management science that Ockham and others have developed, this is, and taking this now into a way that we can simplify it and get it out to farmers. Now, the first step in terms of nitrogen management and thinking of that preseason N rate is to set some attainable yield target. Just to make it simple, I'm keeping just saying 4 tons here. Now, then the second step is estimate how much nitrogen can come from the sources that are already present in the system. And the simple way to measure that is the yield that's attained without nitrogen fertilizer. Because we're really then trying to estimate that response to nitrogen, and the response to nitrogen is what determines the amount of nitrogen fertilizer that's needed. Now, when we want to estimate how much is needed, we're then looking at agronomic efficiency, or that grain yield increase per kilogram of nitrogen applied. So the nitrogen then is a function of the response and a target agronomic efficiency. Now, from our experiences in Asia, in a wet season or moderately yielding season, we aim for about 18 to 20 as the agronomic efficiency. So in simple terms, when it gives a message to farmers or extension, we can say that translates into 50 to 55 or 50 kilograms of nitrogen fertilizer for a one-ton response. In a higher yielding season, that can come down to an agronomic efficiency or come up to an agronomic efficiency of 25 and down to 40 kilograms. In a China or a very inefficient system, even aiming for 15 is a very good efficiency, and with 65. Now, here are some data from the Red River Delta in Vietnam. The top across, there is for different soils in different years, and the top is the yield that was attained with full fertilization and relatively good management, so we can look at this as something like an expected or attainable or target yield. The bottom here are the points of the yield that was attained without nitrogen fertilizer. So here is an example of alluvial soil, which are the most common soils for growing rice. And here is across 5 years. So you can see there's variation in both the yield with best management as well as the yield without nitrogen. So really building upon the work of Ken Kassman and others in the past, that the nitrogen supply can vary a great deal. So when we actually then look at that response or the difference between the two, we can see it's actually not that variable. That N response is from about 1 to 3 tons here across that alluvial soil. So now we can say, well, why do we go through all this work in terms of making a simple fertilizer recommendation when we have to estimate the attainable yield and we have to estimate the amount of nitrogen supply from the soil? Why don't we just make it simple and look at instead some categories of estimated nitrogen response? So if we want to really simplify this down when we go to extension workers, take all this science, good science, it's still robust, we can think in terms of just trying to get those indicators and measures in an environment that will help us just be able to say, is it a 1, 2, or a 3-ton response to nitrogen? And then use that estimated response with a target agronomic efficiency to get an approximate preseason rate of nitrogen. And that is one of the ways that we're really simplifying all that science down into trying to get simple messages that can go to extension that can then pass that on to farmers. And then we're trying to put it into a context of management by growth stages of a crop, because a farmer can only take so much information at any given time. So here is the way we would then present nitrogen management in terms of different growth stages. Early nitrogen in the Asian tropical rice environment means not too much nitrogen early, not too much excessive tillering and vegetative growth. As I'll mention later, it really can make the plants susceptible to disease. Then with active tillering and panicle initiation, very critical stages for applying nitrogen, we have tools like the leaf color chart, and we can also get even more sophisticated in terms of looking at optimal canopies and leaf area index. Now, here is something that put together to address the issue that has anything new been done, or are we just reinventing the wheel when it comes to science? So I looked back at what we were doing in 1987 with nitrogen management, what we're doing today. The key message in 1987 was about nitrogen losses, and those losses were really on our mind. Now we're talking about really the crop and feeding the crop needs. We've moved from recovery efficiency to agronomic efficiency with high yield. Fixed rates and fixed by season have really moved towards response to nitrogen and agronomic efficiency of nitrogen. Basal incorporations that were the key message has now moved on to moderate early nitrogen with varying the rates and distribution during the season as needed. Now I'd like to go on to residue management. Because here now the question come up, can we do away with all these fertilizers and just do with organics? Well, ROP residues are probably the main source of organics, and we know that they are low in content of nutrients, and they're often considered a nuisance and burned. And we're now in the Asian context really looking at a unique system where the soil is flooded, it's tilled under flooded conditions, so that process of puddling is destroying the structure, but controlling weeds and holding water, helping to level the soil. This is building upon the picture, Akeem showed earlier. This is our experience where rice systems, we typically are maintaining soil organic matter because of the puddling and the flooding. Whereas if we go into a rotation, such as with corn here, we're losing soil organic matter, even if we are recycling those residues and incorporating them. So now I'd like to say a little bit more what this means in terms of management practices beyond just tillage. Well, first of all, when we look at puddled soils and the incorporation of residue, the supply of nitrogen is not really increased. Here is the nitrogen supply or nitrogen uptake in the grain and the straw at maturity without and with residue, and we can see no benefit in terms of that residue. That's because of nitrogen immobilization taking place in these rapid turnarounds between rice crops. And there's often no benefit in yield with full fertilization. So we don't see a nitrogen benefit. So if we're looking in rice that's grown with puddled and flooded conditions, the incorporation of residue is not always essential to maintain soil organic matter. We can maintain it even if the residue is removed. It can cause some nuisance in terms of immobilization and problems with the seedlings. With balanced fertilization, we usually don't see a short-term or near-term yield increase. Now, if crops are grown without puddling, then the residue that's returned does not necessarily mean that we're going to prevent loss of soil organic matter if there's heavy tillage. And the incorporation of the residue doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be getting increased yield. So try to put this into a management context then, is then when we're looking at rice that's grown under soil flooding and puddled and flooded conditions in the Asian context. Now this is a bit different than California. Now our research would also show if we had a long fallow period like the winter period in California and the soils were flooded and the residue was decomposing, we would be increasing the indigenous nutrient supply and indigenous release of nitrogen. But that's very rare in the Asian context. There's usually a shorter turnaround time with less water. So residue removal may be a possibility, particularly if we are adding enough nutrients to compensate. If it is incorporated, then intermittent irrigation is important to reduce those methane emissions. Now, if we're looking at rice that's rice or another crop, that, such as wheat in this case, that's grown without soil puddling, or it could be corn, then we're really now having a situation where the rice residue can provide quite an important benefit if it remains in the soil surface as a mulch. And implements such as this are being developed. So here is a very different environment now as there moves into the reduced tillage where residue can now be playing a mulching role, which is quite different than where it's incorporated and providing much less benefit. Now I want to go on to the issues of crop establishment and plant population. We're looking at, in the Asian context, transplanting may or may not be standing water like this. Wet seeding, often without standing water like this, where germinated seeds are broadcast onto leveled soil. Now, what is the ideal plant population? You know, so here is some data to add some recent research to illustrate some of the complexities of determining an optimal hill spacing or plant population with transplanted rice and young seedlings. This is one season of four seasons of data that have been collected in the Red River Delta of North Vietnam. This is from the 2006 summer season. We have two very distinctly different locations. This one here is inbred rice on a infertile soil, but a highly productive soil where there's a considerable amount of manures and fertilizers added. Intensive three crops per year, typically, of rice, and corn. Here is an area that's more of a rice-growing area on heavier clay soils with hybrids, often Chinese hybrids. Now, hill spacing, you can see this is the number of hills per meter square. Right here we're looking at, when we get up to about 45 or so, we're looking at 15 centimeters by 15 centimeters or even tighter spacing than that. Notice on this soil, it needs a very high plant population to get the high yields. Here we got a different situation. So it's can be very location and cultivar specific. And these things are reproducible across the several years of this experiment. Now let's go on to a different environment. This is in the southern part of Vietnam where we have direct wet-seeded rice. Now, one of the real challenges with wet-seeded rice in the Asian context is disease and problems when there's too high of a seed rate. But yet farmers are using high seed rates to reduce risk. And now there's a golden apple snail that eats those seedlings. So there's an added problem and a risk to farmers. So one of the things that scientists have developed is a drum seeder for row seeding as a way to facilitate a lower seed rate as an alternative to broadcasting the seeds by hand. 70 kilograms of seed per hectare is sort of a moderate recommended rate. Farmers could be using up to 150 to 200, so 120 is still a big compromise. Now these two locations are extremely similar. They're nearby, same soils. They're in the same season. And look, two different results. Here we have same yields with all three. You know, there was no difference in yield. Here there was significant differences in yield across those populations, seed rates. Try and figure that out. You know, this kind of site-specific information is there where you can see the optimal seed rate can be location-specific. Now, you can set some hypotheses here. One hypothesis that one could say is that there could be times in which a row spacing, when you have a more open canopy and you have a high disease environment, you could be creating an environment that is less susceptible to some of the pests and diseases, and that could be a factor that could be influencing this. That's, at this point in this data, it's still a hypothesis. This is still just recent season that this was collected. But you can see some of the site specificity and why we need good scientific understanding, or else we'll be doing agronomic trials every place forever. So one of the issues here is sheep blight. It can be a problem in that area, but it's a major problem across Asia. It's a fungal disease with the infection moving up the canopy. And it's very much influenced by the canopy, by the humidity and the leaf-to-leaf contact by which it spreads within the canopy. So this is the work that Xiaobing Peng and others have been particularly instrumental in, is really understanding the importance of how that canopy architecture is and how we can really influence it by not only seed rate, but also nitrogen management and things that farmers can do. Here is an example of over-fertilization of nitrogen. A very unhealthy canopy. There's going to be small panicles inside later in ripening, where we're going to a much healthier canopy here. This can be influenced by management of the crop. And that, in turn, can have quite an influence on the disease or the susceptibility of the crop to disease in seasons where there is a disease problem. Here's an example of data that have been collected in Guangdong province in China, where looking at the severity of sheep blight with some indices from the canopy. SPAD meter here is a chlorophyll meter, basically an indication of the nitrogen status of the plant. So you can see there's a relationship with the leaf area index, stem number, as well as interactions with nitrogen. So when we put that all together for managing, in this case, hybrid rice for reduced sheep blight, we can see that the transmission ratio of light, the temperature in the canopy, the humidity in the canopy were all important factors. And when we, that in explaining the incidence or severity of sheep blight. So when we put that together into management practices, then reduce tiller number, lower nitrogen content in the leaves, greater openness of the canopy can be factors that can be helpful in reducing that disease. Now, it won't be helpful, however, in seasons when the disease is not present, but in those seasons when the disease is present, there can be added benefit. Now, I want to say a little bit about the challenge in reaching 80% of the yield potential, because some of our constraints can be hidden, just as John was talking about micronutrient issues, and we know there are a number of hidden micronutrient issues in terms of zinc as a constraint. I'd like to come back to this figure that I mentioned about why none of us have been able to reach our target in the late wet season. Now, is it just because the models are wrong, or is there some type of problem here that we're not seeing? It can be a really, I think, one of the questions for us. Just in this season right now, five of the six varieties that we have in there were infected with the tungro virus when they were analyzed in the laboratory, but many of them didn't have any visible symptoms. So some of those were the varieties that Dave mentioned. Some of them do have some resistance, but some are susceptible. So that could be a factor here. It could be many other things, but it's just to highlight some of the challenges that we have as agronomists for the future. Now, I think as we move forward with component technologies for where we bring them together, as we're going to need to bring technologies together to solve these problems, we're moving a bit in our strategy and our thinking. You know, we've heard of integrated crop management, or whatever the term is that we use. It can be thought of as a fixed basket or a package of technologies where one fits all. I mean, that's one approach that we have. We can have another approach of where we have a selection from a basket of technologies. What we're trying to do really increasingly in taking science is moving from a noun to a verb, moving from integrated crop management, which is something static, moving to integrating crop management, moving to a process, moving to where we're trying to take science-based principles to optimize at the field level and give farmers that power in decision-making that they can be optimizing more into an action process. So thank you very much.